As his second-in-command positioned the Ekwey broadside to the new target, Casacampo observed the grounded Texican freighter. His flagship's powerful engines throbbed at low thrust, making every horizontal surface vibrate and buzz. On either side of them, the Shibalbe and White Bonesnake had taken up their respective firing positions. All was in readiness. With a curt hand signal through the pilot house glass, Casacampo began the precision shelling of the freighter's top deck. The three tugs launched their first mortar rounds almost simultaneously. Unlike the shelling of the Bill, this was an attack on a visible target, a spectacle to be enjoyed and savored. The commander watched through binocs as the mortars began to land downrange. The explosions were impressive, colorful, loud, and powerful. Orange balls of fire blossomed, tearing the stacks of cargo containers apart, blowing open the boxes on top, sending aloft a confetti of debris. Destruction rained down on the Yokomaru's main deck, from bow to stern. Under the merciless pounding, huge containers fell three stories, crashing to the deck. Some fell over the side. Then the Matachin gunners turned their attention to the bridge tower, which commanded the deck and all access to it. It was the perfect high ground for snipers to hole up. The first shell's explosion cut free the Lone Star flag and took out the top 20 feet of the radar mast. As the huge flag fluttered down through the black smoke and fire, mortar rounds deconstructed the tower. Held together by little more than paint and rust, it came apart even more easily than the cargo containers. Successive explosions, laid one on top of the other, blew out the center of the tower, took it down story by story, leaving a yawning, smoking chasm between the port and starboard outside walls. Meanwhile, the contents of the burst containers were feeding the fire scattered all along the main deck. Flames leapt into the sky, and oily black smoke poured off the bow in a river, blown hard downwind. Casacampo didn't need binocs to see the deck burn. He adjusted the soggy butt of his cigar in the corner of his mouth. To him, the conflagration was a beautiful sight. For the enemy hiding in the ship, it had to be a demoralizing shock. If the Matachin weren't interested in looting their precious pre-dark stores, then those stores couldn't be used as a defense, essentially as a hostage, to forestall all-out attack. As the shelling continued, the commander tried to imagine what it was like being trapped inside that ancient steel can, with giants pounding on the roof. His already weakened opponents, when blown apart, would be prostrated by the combination of sound and concussion. They would be unconscious and disoriented. No trouble for the assault teams to mop up. He anticipated easy pickings, just like Matamoros in Brownsville, an appropriate end to a glorious and victorious campaign. Picking up the microphone, Casacampo flicked on the radio as he hand-signaled his own crew.
Cease fire! Cease fire! Ready the ground assault. Shibalbe, yours is the honor of being first to the beach.
Looking out the pilot house's rear window, he saw the second of the Ekwey's rafts being lowered from its davit into the water. His crew was loading weaponry in the other dinghy, which had already been launched, and which they held tethered on the tug's starboard side. He raised his binocs again and watched as the Shibalbe's rafts headed for shore. His pirates were stroking hard on their oars, eager for the coming slaughter. A thrill coursed through him. His blood pounding, Casacampo reached up and rubbed the belly of a dangling Adipul X icon with the ball of his thumb. For luck. The first Lords of Death had been imprisoned and tortured by secret elements of the Northern government. Because of the horrors that had been done to their ancestors, subsequent lords felt a particular hate for all things Deathlands, but until recently they hadn't been in a position to make their hatred felt. Only recently had it been in their interest to expend military assets to that end. Casacampo knew that the Yokomaru had been bound for Brazil before Armageddon swept it off course. He hadn't seen a copy of the ship's manifest, a copy no longer existed, but he had an idea of what was in it. The contents of the Yokomaru might have been valuable to the Brazilians of the period, or to the Deathlanders, neither of which had anything better, but to the Lords of Death and their minions, the Matachin, it was just century-old, second-rate crap. Casacampo's pirates would, as was their custom, help themselves to whatever gold and jewels they could find, and to the various orifices of the survivors at gunpoint, but as to the other stuff, the cargo of the Yokomaru, the treasure of Padre Island, it was only good for burning. The sooner the pre-dark stockpiles were gone, the faster Deathlands would revert to the Stone Age. Stone Age people couldn't hold territory against automatic weapons and artillery. 600 years before, Casacampo's progenitors, dressed in loincloths and armed with clubs, knives, and magic spells, had tried and failed to repel an invasion by a more technologically advanced civilization. Now, the shoe was on the other foot. A sudden clatter of autofire broke his train of thought. At first, he couldn't tell where it was coming from. There was nothing for his men to shoot at. Then he looked across the water to the grounded ship and saw the muzzle flashes winking all along the side of the hull. He quickly focused the binocs. The gun ports, so narrow he had missed them, were now all too obvious, lit up as they were by gunfire. Casacampo's stomach tightened as he turned the optics on the landing party. Between the Shibalbe and its rafts, the water was being churned to a froth by bullet fall. The Matachin and the dinghy stroked harder, trying to row away from the autofire and make it to the shore. But they weren't going to make it. The commander could see that. As he watched, a hailstorm of lead swept over both of his rafts. The inflatable pontoons were instantly torn to shreds. Some of the Matachin managed to jump or pitch themselves over the sides. Most couldn't get out from behind their oars. Trapped on the thwart seats, the concentrated rifle slugs chewed them to pieces. As the rafts rapidly sank, bodies floated free. The survivors swam hard for the beach, targeted by autofire. Incensed, Casacampo grabbed for the microphone. As the Matachin lowered the angle of their launch tubes, bullets began raining down on the port side of the flagship tug, pelting the roof of the slave's sunshade. The weapons were too far away for accuracy, but the rowers couldn't get out of the way. They tried, pulling on their shackles, taking cover behind their seats and one another. Blood sprayed the deck. Then, the port window of the pilot house imploded, sending glass flying. Casacampo turned his head to avoid being cut in the eyes and face. Standing their ground, the mortar gunners let fly. The shells looped over the water at low angles, with muzzle climb compensating. Bright orange explosions lit up the flank of the ship. The incoming fire shut off in the same instant. Casacampo watched through the binocs as cavernous holes opened up in the hull. Along the row of gun ports, chunks of steel plate flew off like they were made of cardboard. Entire sections of the interior hallway were exposed to view and hit over and over again. Smoke poured from within. It wasn't enough for payback, the commander thought, but it was a start.
Keep firing until we hit the beach! White Bolt Snake, launch your assault teams!
Casacampo picked up his Lapa and headed for the stairs. Delore left the helm, grabbed his own submachine gun and ammo belt, and followed. When they reached the deck, Delore gestured curtly at a lower-ranked crewman.
Man the helm. Hold this position.
Campo stepped into the bow of one of the rafts, already loaded with men and gear. Delore got into the other.
Get moving! We have our will to impose on these dogs of El Norte!
Both dinghies pushed off, and the pirates began rowing around the starboard side of the tug, heading for the shore. Fires raged on the main deck of the freighter, and flames looked out of the holes blown in its flank. There would be no more unpleasant surprises from that quarter. The commander waved his men to the right, to where the half-sunken rafts lay, where the corpses floated. He counted the bodies. They had lost 9 of the 20 men in the 2 rafts. Some had died swimming to shore.
Both crews, recover our property.
The men on both rafts shipped oars and began hooking the corpses with their hands. There were too many to pull into the rafts, so they tied loops of line to ankles, necks, and wrists. It wasn't rowing, and towed their boat to the beach. When the bow of Casacampo's raft slid up on the sand, the White Bone Snake's landing party was already there. They had taken up firing positions on their bellies, aiming up at the ship. There was nothing to shoot at. The 11 survivors from the Shibalbe dinghies were there too, machetes and pistols in hand. With great care and reverence, the Matachin pulled their dead from the water and lined the bullet-riddled bodies up on the shore. Casacampo could sense their speechless fury. He shared it. This was the voyage's greatest loss.
This outrage will be repaid 100 times over, my brothers. Let us go and inflict our vengeance.
Under the cover of guns from the beach, the commander led the way up the dunes to the ramp. They met no resistance en route, and looking over the edge of the ramp as he ascended it, Casacampo saw nothing stirring among the ruins. The hallway exposed by the mortars had been turned into piles of rubbish, as had the enemy. The commander climbed onto the burning deck, moving out of the flow of black smoke. His mortar crew's handiwork was evident. The roof of the central hold had been caved in by successive shell hits. Fire billowed up from within. The bridge tower had been reduced in height by half and nearly cut in two vertically. It was also on fire. Delore touched Casacampo's arm and pointed to the harbor and the tall sailing ship anchored there.
A traitor. Someone could escape on that.
It does not matter. We cannot split our force now, but we can contain whatever survivors there are and secure the trade ship later. Now, you, and you, and you, crewmen, go around the bow and watch for any escapes. Gas anyone who tries to run away. If that doesn't stop them, use lead.
Yes, Commander!
As the pirates set off, the commander stepped to the gate in the rail and signaled down to the beach for the rest of his force to mount the hill and join them. As soon as they hit the deck, Casacampo led his men toward the stern. They leapfrogged around the burning top of containers, covering each other, but the enemy was nowhere to be seen. At the base of the ruined bridge tower, Casacampo had his crew clear the entrance to the stairwell, which was blocked by fallen debris from the shelled structures above. Delore yanked on the twisted door. Smoke poured from the stairwell.
Gas masks and headlamps on now. We will make them pay. We will teach them what pain is. We will teach them to raise their hands against the Matashdeen.
Casacampo pulled on his own gas mask, donned and switched on his headlamp, and was the first down the steps into the smoke and darkness. Ryan awoke with a start from a horrible dream, a nightmare of his own suffocation and violent dismemberment. He tasted blood. He was on his back under a weight that pressed the full length of his body, pinning his arms and legs to the deck. Something lay across the scarred, eyeless left side of his face. He blinked the lid of his functional eye to remove the grit clinging to it. Directly above him, the hallway ceiling had ruptured. Broken, multicolored wires, loops of gray conduit, and disconnected ends of cylindrical aluminum air ducts hung from the breach. Looking down, he could see the debris piled on his chest. He was half buried under ceiling tiles and pieces of the imploded hull and interior walls. With the tip of his tongue, he felt a long cut inside his mouth along his left cheek. The bleeding had pretty much stopped. Then he realized that he couldn't hear anything. He heard all over, all at once. Every time he breathed in, the pain got worse by a factor of 10. There was something he knew he had to remember, but the harder he tried to recall, the further away his thoughts slipped. He closed his eye and forced himself to concentrate on simple, direct questions. Where was he? How had this happened? Who was responsible? Recent events came back to him in a rush of images and recalled sensation. The island, the freighter, the sickness, the pirates, the shelling. And somewhere around him, amid the ruins of the grounded ship's corridor, his companions lay trapped, perhaps dead, perhaps dying. Ryan tried to get up, but he couldn't move arms and legs hidden from sight under the heaped debris. He couldn't make his fingers move either. He hoped that they were just numb from shock like his ears. Then other, more dire possibilities occurred to him. He wondered if he'd been hit by shrapnel and was paralyzed from the neck down, or whether, recalling the grisly details of his blackout dream, his arms and legs had been blown away. He squeezed off the downward spiral of thought and crushed it under a mental boot heel. He had never given in to fear before, and he wouldn't let himself do it now, even with death in sight. Ryan stopped fighting the numbness and forced himself to calm down. He noticed that there was a lot more light coming into the corridor now. Even though the hall was still wreathed in smoke, the pall was rapidly thinning. There was a breeze, too, steady but slight. He could feel it gently brushing against his exposed cheek. After a minute or so, Ryan managed to turn his head a little to the right and saw the holes in the plating. 4-foot-wide sections of the corridor's exterior wall and the ship's hull were missing. Those yawning gaps left the deck open to the air and the elements, floor to ceiling. Where mortar shells had directly hit the gun ports, the steel was peeled back into jagged crowns. From the scorch patterns across the ceiling, some of the shells had shot through and into the upper tween deck hold, sending explosive backwash and flame into the hallway as they detonated. Like thawing ice, from his shoulders down his arms to his elbows, from his hips down his legs, the feeling started to creep back, along with a burning, rippling electric sensation and intense localized pain. When Ryan commanded his right arm to move, the progressive thaw worked its way to his fingers. The backs of both hands burned like they were being blowtorched. He could feel his individual fingers, though. They were heavy, wooden, but he could feel them. With an effort, he pushed his hand up through the pile of dropped tiles and then swept them off his face and chest. When he rose to an elbow, soot and metal dust fell away from his face and t-shirt. The burning sensation coursed down his legs to his toes. Hurting like hell was a good sign, he decided. Ryan kicked the rubbish off himself and saw the rear stock of the Steyr laying across his left hip. He pulled it out from under the tiles. Bracing the butt of the Steyr on the deck and gripping the barrel, he used it to regain his feet. He felt an odd, constant pressure, a tightness at the base of his spine. When he reached back, he found the loaded AKM mag still tucked under his belt. Nothing moved in either direction down the hallway. Wisps of smoke hung just under what was left of the ceiling. Debris was everywhere, but it lay mostly heaped against the foot of the interior wall. More smoke, only black and oily, poured through massive holes blown in that same wall. How could anyone have survived? How had he survived? Ryan looked out through a missing section of hull. Down on the shore, he saw 4 beached, intact rafts. In front of them, bodies were lined up in a row, at least a dozen. Presumably pirate bodies, those chilled by the islanders' massed rifle fire. Between the shore and the ship, there were no sign of the invaders. There were no pirates on the ramp. Ryan realized with a jolt that the enemy was already aboard.
Get up! Get up! The bastards are coming! Is anyone left alive? Get up!
Here and there along the interior wall, low piles of wreckage started to shift. Then dusty heads, hands, and arms began to appear. Ryan launched himself in the direction he'd last seen Christy and Doc. Slinging the Steyr, he started frantically turning over the large debris. He found Christy behind a lean-to of hull plate, curled up with her back pressed to the foot of the interior wall. She wasn't moving.
Don't be dead. Don't be dead.
Then he saw her chest rising and falling. When he tipped the section of steel plate over and let it crash onto the floor, she stirred. Her eyes opened, and she blinked up at him, dazed.
Gaia.
There was blood on her face and hands. He helped her to her feet, quickly checking her over for major injuries. She seemed to be okay. The blood was from shallow shrapnel cuts, one along her jawline, one above her right eye, several on the backs of her hands.
They're coming! The pirates are coming! Find the others!
He pointed her toward the bow. Whether she could hear him, or whether she read his lips, or whether she just figured it out for herself, she nodded. After shaking the dust from her tightly coiled red hair, she rushed off and began searching the rubble. There was no time to dwell on the uncovered legs, arms, and heads that were no longer connected to live persons. As it turned out, quite a few people had lived through the attack, but only a handful hadn't suffered grievous injury. There was nothing to be done for the wounded. Ryan could see that from just looking at them. Even if their bleeding could have been stopped, the protruding hunks of shrapnel successfully removed, the injuries they suffered were terrible. Not only were they massive and internal, but packed with soot and rust. Infection was almost guaranteed. Infection and slow, agonizing death. 10 feet away from Ryan, a section of blown inward hull suddenly tipped away from the interior wall and crashed over onto the deck. Doc, coated with dust and bleeding from his nose and ears, unfolded himself from the floor. When he saw Ryan standing there, his expression brightened.
Come on, Doc. Help me look for the others.
Together, they found Brenda, Garwood, and JB. All three were alive. All three could move. Brenda was alert and immediately stood and cleared the action of her pump gun. The boy seemed to be in a state of shock. JB was in even worse shape, clutching his ribs with an arm, squinting behind dusty spectacles. His face was dead white.
Oh, fuck!
Doc put a hand on Ryan's shoulder to get his attention, then pointed toward the bow. Christy was waving urgently at them. Harmonica Tom was at her side. He was waving too. Ryan broke into a run, and the others followed. As they approached Christy and Tom, he saw the fire talker standing behind the skipper. Daniel appeared to have come through the barrage dirtied but unscathed. His survivalist do-rag was canted at an odd angle over one ear. Then, Ryan saw Mildred. She was on her knees, leaning over a still form on the deck. A pale form.
Oh no.
It was Jack. Ryan knelt on the other side of the albino teen. There wasn't a mark on him, not anywhere. Not a drop of spilled blood on the dead white face. But his chest wasn't moving. For a second, Ryan thought for sure Jack was dead, that the concussions had caused him a fatal internal torso or brain injury. Mildred hadn't given up, though. She quickly rubbed the colorless hands between hers and lightly slapped Jack on the cheeks.
Come on, Jack. Wake up, honey.
After a second, his ruby red eyes opened. Ryan was relieved when Jack pushed away Mildred's hands and rose to his feet, albeit shakily.
Can you all hear me?
There were nods all around, even from the boy Garwood. His eyes were bloodshot, but clear and focused. He had shaken off the shock.
Hearing's coming back.
Collect your blasters and ammo. We gotta regroup with the Islanders. Make a stand.
He pointed back down the corridor to where Brenda and the other survivors stood huddled, checking their weapons and ammo. There weren't very many defenders left. Of the original 25, only 7 remained, counting Garwood. The rest lay in pieces or dying in the rubble. As the companions passed the bulkhead door to the upper tween deck hold, Garwood headed straight for the latch. Christy tried to put a hand on his arm, but he shook her off.
You don't want to see what's in there.
Garwood cracked open the latch, yanked the door ajar, and looked inside. He froze in place. Ryan looked in, over the boy's shoulder. The destruction was absolute, and there was plenty of daylight to view it, despite the haze of rising smoke. A jagged 30-foot-wide hole had been blown into the roof of the hold. An even bigger hole had been blown into the center of the deck, 3 times as big as the cargo container that had fallen into it. Oily black smoke was pouring up out of the breach. The hold's metal walls were scorched to the ceiling and slashed by fragments from exploding shells. Nobody, nothing, was alive in there. Ryan gently moved the boy aside and stepped over the threshold. Standing out of the flow of harsh smoke, he looked over the edge of the central hold. The deck of the hold 1 story below had been penetrated by HE as well. He could see all the way down into what looked like the ship's engine room. He could just make out the tops of massive engine blocks. That's where the fire was burning. As he stepped back through the door, Ryan took Garwood by the shoulders and tried to turn him away from the entrance, away from the spectacle. The teenager dug in his heels and resisted.
Come on. They're all gone. It's done.
Garwood wiped away tears with the back of his hand. He let Ryan steer him toward the stern. Before they could move more than a few feet from the doorway, Brenda and the other surviving Islanders joined them. The big-armed woman pushed past Ryan and stared into the hold. Her face visibly sagged as she took in the mess. The upper tween deck was blast-blackened all the way up the walls. All that was left of her people were bloody rags.
There's nothing we can do for them.
Yeah, there is. We can kick the asses of the bastards who did this.
The pirates outnumber us big time. Maybe 4-1. We don't know what kind of armament they have. We need to make a fighting retreat to someplace we can defend.
He's right. You know he's right.
Tom, you and yours can do whatever the fuck you want. But for us Texicans, it's time for some bloody fucking payback!
Brenda racked the slide on her pump gun, chambering around. As the big armed woman stormed off in the direction of the stern stairwell, which was about 200 feet away, the islanders followed, their weapons up and ready.
Damn it, Brenda! Don't do this!
Brenda didn't respond. She kept on walking away, shoulders hunched, head lowered. They all kept on walking for the stairwell. When Garwood hitched himself up and started to go after Brenda, Tom reached out and grabbed him by the arm.
No way, boy. You're coming with us, and we're getting the hell out of here.
I want to fight him! Let me go!
We all want to fight him and chill him, and we will. But we don't necessarily have to commit suicide doing it.
Garwood tried to throw a roundhouse punch at the skipper's face, but missed when the larger man easily and adroitly pushed him off balance.
Stop it, boy!
From there, it degenerated into a stand-up wrestling match. While they struggled, the islanders disappeared up the stairs, heading for the top deck. Ryan and Doc moved in and separated Tom and the boy.
Shit. The islanders walked right into it.
Ryan drew his Sig Sauer and stepped to the left, giving himself a clear firing lane. Christy, Mildred, Doc, Jack, and Tom whipped their pistols out as well. Garwood dropped to a knee on the deck in front of them, shouldered his AKM, and aimed at the stairwell entrance. JB couldn't shoulder his scattergun, so he held it braced against his hip, his face twisted in a grimace of pain. Ryan noted that the fire talker hung well back of them all, empty-handed. Though there were a lot of Islander weapons hidden under the debris, he didn't try to find one for himself. In fact, Daniel had a kind of wild look in his eye, as if he were on the verge of making a solo break for it while the companions held the fort. But he didn't bolt. He didn't move a muscle. The Fabulator was too spineless, even to hightail it. Ryan turned his attention back to the stairwell. They had enough weapons. Any pirate who stepped down onto the landing was going to be shot to pieces in a heartbeat. Then, an olive-drab cylinder bounced off the last step onto the landing. It was spewing dense white smoke as it rolled into the corridor.
Gas grid! Get the fuck back!
The hissing canister was followed by Brenda. The big woman wasn't moving under her own power. She slid on her back, head first down the steps. Gravity dumped her at the foot of the stairs. She wasn't dead. She struggled to her feet, bleeding heavily from a shoulder wound that had already soaked one side of her bird hunting vest. Tear gas from the canister billowed all around her as she lurched half-blinded for the hallway. Before she could clear the landing, she was chopped down by multiple impacts to the head and chest. She collapsed to the floor and stayed there. Light beams speared through the caustic chemical fog, crisscrossing wildly. Ryan put a hand on Garwood's shoulder.
Warn him, son.
The teenager cut loose a withering burst with his AKM. The flurry of slugs slapped the far side of the landing and sparked, gnawing chunks of metal from the edge of the entry arch. While the pirates were thinking twice about taking those last few steps to the deck, Ryan waved the others away toward the bow. He knew they couldn't hold the corridor against a tear gas attack. Even with the outer wall blown and a breeze coming through the holes, the chemicals would hang in the air, blinding and incapacitating them, making them very easy to kill. Two more canisters bounced down the steps and onto the hallway. The Grens pinwheeled, spurting clouds of cottony smoke. Garwood raised his assault rifle to his shoulder to lay down more covering fire, but Ryan stopped him with a hand on the still warm barrel.
We need a way off this deck. Then we need a way off this ship.
Jack bent and picked up an AKM from the rubble, tapping the flash hider against the side of his boot to clear any debris from the barrel. Without even choking the mag, he took aim at the landing. The thing was either loaded or it wasn't. Jack emptied the magazine.
Get us out of here, Garwood.
This way.
Garwood ran for the bow. Daniel was right behind him, almost a shadow. Ryan grabbed the AKM from Jack and holstered his Sig Sauer.
Come on, everybody go.
He stripped out the empty mag and reached behind his back for the clip he had stashed there. As the others ran past him, following Garwood, he slapped in the full magazine, snapped the actuator, and took rear guard. Even though the three canisters were hissing a good 200 feet distant, he could already feel his eyes starting to sting and burn. The slight wind was carrying the CS smoke his way. Before he was blinded by tears, Ryan fired from the hip, sending half a clip through the archway. Then he turned and chased after the others. The freighter's hallway was close to 600 feet long, a hell of a sprint, made more difficult because it was over an obstacle course of exploded rubbish. When Ryan saw the companions ducking through an arch at the far end of the corridor, he whirled and emptied the AKM down the hall. Tossing the rifle aside, he raced for the landing of the forward, portside stairwell. As he stepped onto the landing, return fire from the stern clanged all around the bulkhead, spitting fat sparks as they ricocheted every which way. Ryan whipped around the corner and down the stairs. The stairwell was wreathed in smoke. The smoke was even thicker at the next landing. He could feel radiating warmth against his face and arms. Whatever was burning, it was plenty hot. As he continued down the stairs, he saw a yellow flickering light below, too small and too weak to be the source of all the smoke. It was a torch. Ryan saw dim shapes on the tween deck landing.
They're coming. Maybe 3 minutes behind me.
Boy, can you get us out of here?
Through the buildings. There's a breach on the other side of the ship. It's real low on the hull, near the keel. You can't see it from the water. The sand dunes hide it.
If we go out that way, can we get around the vill and make it down to the shore?
Hell yes. We can skirt the vill's backside, straight down to the water. Clear shot from the beach to the dinghy.
We've got to go through the engine room to get to it. And the engine room's back the way we just came by.
Nuke in hell.
JB tried to stop coughing, his arm wrapped around his injured side. His smudged spectacles reflected the yellow flame of the torch. Eyeing him with concern for a moment, Mildred glanced at Garwood.
No other way to the engine room?
Nope. Not from here.
If the Mattachine went down that aft staircase, the one Brenda tried to go up, then they've already got us cut off.
If they didn't, then we've got a chance.
Ryan grabbed a pair of unlit torches from the wall and gave one of them to Jack.
We need more light.
As they touched the ends of their torches to Garwood's, more smoke wrens popped on the stairwell above.
Garwood, don't get too far ahead. Don't lose us. Without you to guide us, we're running blind in here. Okay. Go, boy, go!
They ran single file back toward the stern, another 600-yard sprint. There was less debris on this deck, for sure, but it was harder to see through it through the dense smoke. In the lead, Garwood picked his way around the scattered obstacles. Everyone followed his path, more or less. JB was having a hard time keeping up. He gradually dropped back in the line until he was running right in front of Ryan. They had traveled about half the distance to the stern when the smoke began to ease off and the heat got a whole lot worse. And there was a kind of red, throbbing glow up ahead on the left. The pirates had gained the lower deck, but were shooting wild. Ryan risked a glance back, couldn't see through the smoke. As another burst of slugs whined by him, Ryan could visualize the enemy's target picture, running figures silhouetted by the madly shifting red-orange glow. Stopping and returning fire was not an option for the companions. Speed was their only hope. Once they got past the glow and slipped into the darkness beyond, from the pursuer's point of view, they would simply disappear. The air was so hot, it felt like daggers stabbing deep in Ryan's lungs every time he inhaled. JB was staggering a bit, but he still had his eyes on the prize. Like Ryan, he knew the glow of the fire would hide them. The glow was coming up fast on the left. Ryan's clothes were soaked through with sweat. Even the shortest possible breaths seared the inside of his nose and the back of his throat. Ryan assumed that the pirates were concentrating on their running, trying to close the gap and overtake them before they vanished. 50 feet in front of them, a torrent of flame shot sideways out of the left-hand wall, floor to ceiling. At the head of the file, Garwood veered wide right to avoid being cooked in his own skin. And it wasn't just direct flame he was dodging. Ryan could see the steel wall around its exit point was what was glowing red.
Shit! That's from in front! They cut us off!
He couldn't see muzzle flashes down the corridor ahead of them for the light of the leaping flames, but bullets weren't flying from that direction. When JB darted away from the source of the scalding heat, running next to the exterior wall, Ryan followed in his footsteps. 20 feet away and rapidly closing, he saw fire blasting out through the doorway of what had to be the upper tween deck hold. The door was open, locked back against the wall. There was suddenly a hard wind at Ryan's back as the fire greedily sucked oxygen through every hole and crack in the hull, feeding itself. Holding his breath to keep his lungs from being scorched, Ryan got a brief glimpse through the doorway. Everything inside looked like it was burning. It was wall-to-wall fire. From the hold, dozens of rounds went off at once, and bullets cut through the interior wall, angling up into the ceiling. Wild volleys of slugs chewed up the tiles overhead and dropped them on top of the companions as they ran. It was the Islanders' ammo stockpile stored in the upper tween deck hold, cooking off from the heat of the fire. Ryan raced past the door and the seething red glow and ran for the darkness ahead, although momentarily blinded by the afterimage of the glare. The blistering heat shifted from his face and left side to his back. No one had been hit by anything but glowing tiles and dust. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of rounds were going off at once. More and more of it slashed through the wall and ricocheted against the inside of the hull. Probably most of it was stashed inside a steel cargo container, which explained why more rounds weren't flying around. It was a situation that could change at any second if the container walls gave way. Ryan hoped that the discharging ammo was going to be a major obstacle for the pirates to negotiate. It might even turn them back. Now the air felt cooler against Ryan's face, but there was noticeably more smoke and the light thrown by his torch was dimmer. Up ahead, Garwood's light had stopped. He knelt at the arch in the wall that led to the aft staircase landing, then poked his AKM around the corner and upward. Tom moved to the other side of the entrance, aiming his big Smith downward. He glanced back to the others. Ryan set his torch on the deck and drew his pistol.
We're clear.
I've got the rear. Keep moving.
With Ryan covering the retreat with his Sig Sauer, the companions hurried down the staircase. He strained his ears to hear the sounds of other footfalls, either from the steps above or from the hallway in the direction of the fire. But he couldn't hear anything over the noise of the exploding ammo and the fire. He sure as hell couldn't see anything for the smoke.
Ryan! We're down!
Ryan picked up his torch and followed. As he descended, the smoke got thinner and thinner, and there was light coming from below. After another landing and another short flight of steps, the stairway ended on the engine room steel floor. Everyone had their guns out. Everyone but the fire talker, who had retreated deeper into the room and was taking cover beside a steel cabineted bank of gauges and dials. Tom and Garwood were stationed to pour withering gunfire onto the foot of the staircase. They lowered their weapons momentarily, allowing Ryan to step into their midst. The ship's engine room was low-ceilinged and cave-like, about 100 feet long and half that wide. Its four engines were enormous, easily 30 feet long, and mounted in side-by-side pairs. The great rusting hulks dominated the center of the space. They had pipe railings around them and catwalks above them. Torchlight was hardly necessary. The intense blaze erupting from between the pairs of engines threw a bright, if wavering, light over the room. To Ryan, it looked like mortar rounds had ignited some remnant of diesel in the freighter's tanks or fuel lines. It was hot as hell, but not nearly as bad as it had been on the deck above. The heat from the fire and most of the diesel smoke was being sucked upward through the irregular gap blown into the ceiling. The holes in the decks above acted like a huge chimney.
Sounds like the ammo cook-off is slowing down.
Hey, Garwood, which way?
Without a word, Garwood headed for the stern end of the engines. The riveted deck and walls were covered with peeling white paint, which was stained with streaks of rust and dark, fuzzy blotches of mildew. Mildred pointed down the deck toward the bow.
Oh, good grief, watch out!
Low, black blurs were circling around and around, almost too quickly to follow. There were dozens of them scrambling in panic. The ship's trapped and terrified rats were going crazy. Garwood put down his torch and his assault rifle and bent over a circular hatch set low on the wall, just above the join with the deck. It had a wheel lock on the engine room side, which he managed to turn without help. The hatch opened onto a black hole. Air whooshed in through it, smelling like rotten eggs. Tom's face twisted at the stink.
The bilges.
Garwood gathered up his weapon and torch and disappeared through the hole, backward. His torchlight flickered in the opening, growing fainter by intervals. One by one, the others slipped through the circular hole.
Hurry up, I can hear them!
JB got past the opening, but with difficulty because his range of arm motion was limited by his rib injury. Then it was Ryan's turn to descend. After holstering his Sig Sauer, he backed through the low hole. He found the steps of a stationary steel ladder for the toes of his boots. As he started down, bracing one hand on the inside of the hatch, gunfire roared from the other side of the engine room. Bullets banged against the hatch as he slammed it shut. He felt the impacts of the slugs all the way up his left arm, into the socket of his shoulder. There was no way to dog the hatch from the inside. 20 feet below, torchlight danced in a ring where the companions waited for him. The dome of light that was cast revealed a gleaming, black, velvety liquid spreading out in all directions. The perimeter of the enclosure was invisible, too wide across for the weak light to reach its edges. Ryan hurried down the ladder. The lake of black stuff was a remnant of the freighter's supply of bunker oil, he guessed. More than a century ago, when the huge ship had been driven aground, its ruptured fuel tanks had bled down into the bilges. Diluted with seawater, the remaining oil was worthless as fuel, but even after the passage of all that time, the stench of sulfur was still overpowering. By the time he reached the bottom of the ladder, Garwood was already leading the others across the shallow lake on a makeshift walkway. It was constructed of rough planking laid down on top of metal boxes and crates. The footing was wobbly at best, and in places it was slicked with oil. It wasn't meant for a mass, high-speed exodus. Walking ahead of Ryan, JB lost his balance as the planking shifted underfoot.
Ah, shit!
He plunged in, up over his shins in the gunk.
Give me your hand!
Ryan quickly helped him back up onto the walkway. On the starboard side of the ship, directly in front of them, Garwood had set the butt of his torch in a hole in one of the I-beams. It illuminated a half-sheet of grubby plywood that rested against the hull, half in, half out of the bilge water. When the teenager slid the barrier aside, bright light streamed into the bilge through a jagged horizontal breach. Ryan looked up over his shoulder, back the way they'd come, and saw a crescent of light above where the ladder started, where the hatch was. He whipped out his six-hour and pivoted.
Move out!
The crescent opened wider, and this time auto-fire sprayed down into the bilge. Ryan stood his ground, and with a two-handed grip, put three tightly spaced rounds into the gap between the hatch and the wall. The hatch stayed open. Ryan turned and quick-stepped along the planking to the breach in the hole. There was no longer anyone in front of him. Everyone else had already ducked through the break and was out the other side. When he looked back one last time to check for pursuit, his six-hour up and ready to fire in his right fist, grins spewing clouds of gas were falling from the hatch into the bilge. They plopped into the bilge water, their caustic fumes boiling from the greasy surface like steam. Too little, too late. Ryan crawled through the opening, out into sunlight so bright it hurt his eye. It took a couple of seconds before he could see his surroundings. At his back, towering six stories or more above him, was the rusting hull of the freighter. In front of him was the dished-out back of a low sand dune. Harmonica Tom had the point. He was already cresting the top of the dune, and the others were scampering after him single file. Mildred had hold of JB's arms on the undamaged side of his ribs, helping him up the slope. Stire in hand, Ryan brought up the rear. When he got to the summit of the dune, he looked down on a 150-foot-long, unprotected stretch of sand. It was all that stood between them and the backside of the burning ville. They'd gone about 50 feet down the hill when Ryan suddenly realized he hadn't seen the fire talker.
Where the fuck did he go?
Earlier, Daniel had backed up, slowly moving out of the ring of light cast by the torches as he watched Eyepatch and his crew, one by one, flee out the hole in the wall. Nobody seemed to notice his absence. Bilge water filled his boots, and it got deeper. He was up to his knees in it, when from behind, he felt the warm steel of the bilge wall.
What do I do? What do I do? Oh, shit, shit, shit!
The pathetic plague carrier trembled in the filth, torn with indecision. If he waited for his masters here, he'd likely die. If he followed Eyepatch, his masters would shoot him, thinking he was deserting. Movement and light up near the ceiling caught Daniel's attention. He watched as the clutch of CS gas grenades dropped through the opening, and he knew what was coming next. The killing was going to be non-selective. Anyone stricken by tear gas, staggering around in the bilge, was dead meat. Before his eyes started watering, Daniel made his break. He sloshed around the perimeter, then crawled through the breach in the hull. As he stuck his head out, he saw Eyepatch cresting the top of the dune. Daniel visualized the terrain leading down behind the ville to the water, specifically the open stretch between ship and destroyed shanties, which for a brief interval would leave the deserters visible and vulnerable. Seizing on the chance to further ingratiate himself in the eyes of his masters, Daniel stepped away from the hull without leaving the dish of doom.
¡Allá los otros! ¡Allá los otros!
He waved his arms and pointed. From the deck high above him, Daniel watched grenade launchers firing, sending grenades over the top of the dune. He pumped his fist in the air.
Yes, sir!
Daniel flinched as a bullet zinged into the sand at his feet, missing his shoulder and neck by no more than half an inch.
Soy Daniel! Soy Cuentista del Fuego!
Thinking it was his accent, Daniel waved his arm frantically in supplication and surrender, making himself visible. He was forced to duck back into the ship when the shooter on the main deck replied by opening up full auto. Harmonica Tom's spirit skyrocketed the second he climbed out of the putrid bilge into full Texican sunlight. All of a sudden, escape seemed not only possible, but highly likely. His elation and his hope both faded as he summited the facing dune. Beyond the northeast end of the island, he saw four sets of sails bearing down.
Shit! They're already through the Aransas Pass and into the waterway. The wind's behind them. This is gonna be nuking tight.
Tom was relieved to see the shacks on the outer edge of the ville were still standing. While they'd provide no cover from high-powered rifle fire, they'd block the shooter's view of targets running down to the beach. He lowered his head and really picked up the pace, taking the slope in long, even strides. The red-haired woman, Christy, was behind him. She was keeping up, no problem, and she was maintaining a 20-foot distance, calculated to make accurate sniper fire from the ship more difficult. When he heard the shouting from the freighter, a chill rippled up Tom's backbone. Behind and to the right, he heard double gas grins bursting in the sand. He didn't look back, but he knew the steady breeze would sweep the cottony clouds over the folks running single file after him.
Don't stop! Don't stop!
Tom dove behind the nearest shack and around the bend. When he looked back, he saw he was alone.
Shit!
Higher up the hill, he saw familiar figures on their knees, shrouded by dense clouds of CS smoke. Some were doubled over and retching in the sand. The red-haired woman stood between him and the others, about 40 feet away. She was apparently unaffected by the gas as well. Christy looked at him expectantly.
No, Christy!
When he didn't make a move to come back to join her, she scowled at him and abruptly turned away, running toward the smoke and her companions. Tom just stood there for a moment, his guts twisted in a knot. There wasn't any help he could give her or her friends. He imagined what it would be like trying to guide six blinded, vomiting people to the water, to the dinghy, and to Tempest. If he did that, no one would get away. There was something else, too. He knew the significance of the awnings on the Matachin tugs. He had seen similar sunshades before. He knew the tugs had been converted into slave galleons. Sharing that fact with Ryan and the others, it seemed a pointless infliction of torture. At the time, the odds were better that they would end up shot anyway. Now he wished he had told them. Bottom line, dead over someone else's oar was definitely not how Harmonica Tom wanted to check out. He leapt to his feet and ran back for the ville and the beach, leaving Ryan and the others to their fate. He felt bad about it, but he did it just the same. Who was shooting, Tom couldn't tell, but the redhead had a handgun, he recalled. Whatever had happened, it was over. He knew the additional six shots in his handgun wouldn't have changed the outcome one bit. When Tom reached the water, he turned left and raced along the shore, into the acrid smoke blowing off the ville. Nothing but smoke was moving inside the perimeter. Smoke and ash. The rows of huts had been turned into a smoldering rubbish pile. As he ran past the uncovered burial trench, he realized that the whole island had become an open grave. The dinghy was where he'd left it, and it hadn't been hit by mortar shrapnel. Turning the bow around, he pushed the raft into the water, jumped in the stern, and grabbed up the oars. He stroked hard for his ship. Because every second counted, when he pulled up to the Tempest, he didn't try to pull the dinghy aboard by himself. He just tied the bow off on a side cleat of Tempest and climbed aboard. Jumping into the cockpit, he ducked below decks and immediately started the engine. The ship had swung around on its anchor. It was pointed bow into the breeze, 180 degrees in the wrong direction. This wasn't Captain Tom Wolfe's first hasty getaway. It was more like his 50th. Trouble and close scrapes were part and parcel of the trader lifestyle. He knew exactly what to do and when to do it. Gunning the motor, he slipped it in forward gear. As the ship moved ahead, it took the strain off the anchor line. He left the ship in gear, left it slowly creeping forward, and ran to the bow. He grabbed the crank handle and winched up the anchor as fast as he could. After he locked it off with the eye bolt, he looked toward the ruined JFK Causeway Bridge, and his heart did a little flutter. The pirate sails were about a quarter of a mile away and closing rapidly.
Come on, Tom. Move it.
Tom raced back to the cockpit and cut the wheel hard over, making Tempest pivot to port. It was a painfully slow, tight turn. Before the ship came around 180, he was up on the deck, frantically freeing the lines that allowed him to raise all sails. Wind filled them, and because the rudder was hard over, the ship completed the half turn in a hurry. He looked over his shoulder and saw the first pursuit ship coming down on him fast. Two pirates with rifles knelt on the bowsprit, shoulder to shoulder. The water in the channel was calm, perfect for shooting. The distance between Tom's ship and the pirates had dwindled to about 200 feet. The Tempest was picking up speed, moving faster and faster. Tom decided it was time to show them this bee had a sting in its tail. He reached up for the PKM's pistol grip and pinned the trigger. As the machine gun blazed, he swept the muzzle back and forth, sending heavy slugs stitching across the oncoming bow. The full metal jacket rounds banged the anchor and skipped off the steel rails of the pulpit. One of the shooters crumpled under the hail, and as he did, he lost his weapon over the side. The other pirate grabbed him by the arm, or he would have gone overboard too. With the shooters occupied, Tom stood from behind his armored cockpit, took careful aim, and gave the bow of the ship another sustained burst for good measure. He streamed autofire down the ship's center line, blasting holes in the steel masts, skimming the cabin roof and the cockpit. The second volley made the remaining shooter abandon his post, abandon his comrade, and duck for cover. And it forced the captain of the pirate ship to take evasive action, slewing his ship from side to side, trying to make the machine gun miss. It slowed the pursuit. In the confines of the channel, the slowing lead vessel was like a plug in a bottle. There wasn't room for the ships chasing behind to pass, and if they didn't slow down as well, they would ram into each other from the rear. Tom's mind was running triple speed as he turned back for the cockpit. How fast were the pirates really? Could he outrun them? And what kind of seas? Were they carrying RPGs or something else that could reach out long distance and sink him? The questions had no answers. But he knew he had to be prepared for the worst. The worst being that he couldn't get cleanly away and that the enemy ships would swing in close enough to throw grappling hooks and board him. He thought back to the longest chases he'd ever had. They'd all been eventually broken off by bad weather. That was not something he could count on here. After taking a bearing on the northwestern tip of the island, he lashed the helm in position with a loop of rope. As he slipped below decks, the rifle fire from the rear resumed. Bullets slapped into the stern and ricocheted off the cockpit armor. They weren't giving up. Tom hurried into the salon and grabbed one of the backpacks of C4. Then he hauled it up the companionway steps into the cockpit. He was greeted by slugs plinking into the main boom and chipping divots in the fiberglass deck. When he looked over the armor, he saw the pirate ships had broken their single-file formation. The channel had widened. They were coming after him two abreast, and they were gaining. He quickly untied the wheel and adjusted course, putting the wind square on his sails. Tempest's hull sliced through the water as it picked up a tad more speed.
Come on, baby. Come on.